Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Virtues of Peace. My name is Hope Elizabeth May and I'm very happy to be joined by Taylor Ackerman.
Hello.
Randy Olson.
Hello, hello.
And very special guest, Charlie Hanley.
Hello, very nice to be with you.
We're honored to have you with us, Charlie. So we don't know if we'll get through all that we have to talk about today. And so Charlie has said that he will join us again if we don't get through all of this very long and detailed story about the Korean War. Today marks the 70th anniversary of the Korean War. And Charlie, in 1999, very famously broke a story with his AP team of journalists, Sung Hyun Che and Martha Mendoza, about the Nogunri massacre, which we'll be talking about later. He has a new book that's going to be coming out in August of this year called Ghost Flames, which is also about the Korean War. And we'll be talking about some of the things that are discussed in both books, but to connect with what we did last week and what we're doing for the next few shows, this is a mini-series devoted to the Korean War, and we began last week with a different narrative in which we, as we said in the title, enter the forest or begin the narrative of the Korean War by beginning with this essay published in 1912 by Bertha von Suttner called The Barbarization of the Sky, and we're going to continue with that theme. So last week, if you're interested, we talked a little bit about Bertha von Suttner. We talked a little bit about this text, but this is all laying a foundation to look at the Korean War through the barbarization of the sky, not only in the north, but also in the south. So that is where we are going. The sky and the U.S. Air Force, what was done during the Korean War is really not known, and this brings us to the titles of Charlie's books. The first one, which came out in 2001, called The Bridge at Nogunri. And the subtitle of that is A Hidden Nightmare from the Korean War. And then his new book is Ghost Flames, Life and Death in a Hidden War, Korea 1950 to 1953. And this is, as we've said, the Korean War is known in the U.S. as the Forgotten War. And so Charlie Hanley has really uncovered hidden stories within this hidden or forgotten war. And I like the phrase double amnesia to describe. We just really don't know about the war in general or about the specific nightmares in particular. And Charlie, let's just begin by talking about the titles of your book and this repeated use of the adjective hidden in both of your books. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, the Nogunri massacre hit the headlines in America and around the world in 1999 like a real bombshell. I like to say it just didn't fit the script of history because Americans are brought up to think that, well, sure, there was a massacre in Vietnam called My Lai, but American troops just don't do such things. That was a real anomaly in Vietnam. But we confirmed this massacre at Nogunri by American ground troops and American warplanes, and it therefore could be described as a single hidden nightmare. It was this one event that came to light due to our work and that shocked the American people and made front pages all over the country. Then over the years after that, as a journalist, once you deal with a subject like this, things come your way. People come your way with stories, with documents and such. And between the years 2000 and 2010, I continued doing work with Korean colleagues, in particular, traveling back and forth to Seoul. And we reported on many other nightmares, hidden nightmares, if you will. And consequently, those have been wrapped into the new book in many ways with many characters. The new book tells the story of the Korean War, a complete story of the Korean War as a narrative, drawing on the experiences of 20 featured individuals, and I call them characters, but of course they're real people and these are real experiences. And so by now, by the year 2020, we can describe the whole war as hidden because there's so much that wasn't known and has emerged really only in the past 2 decades in particular. And one example, and I lead the prologue to the new book with this example, was in the year 2002, a typhoon called Rusa struck South Korea and did a lot of damage, very devastating. And one thing it did was it blew away a layer of earth that had covered a mass grave of these political people killed as political prisoners early in the Korean War in July of 1950. And this is the way these facts began emerging. And of course, journalists and historical researchers and forensic scientists and others went to work through the decade, the first decade of the 21st century, uncovering more and more of this sort of information. And so the Korean War, which, yeah, you're right, Hope, it long has been known as the Forgotten War, but it could just as rightfully be called a hidden war.
And to get us more into the details of these hidden nightmares within a hidden war and this idea of the truth being buried, let me begin. This is, you can find this on our show resources page. This is actually found in the book, The Barbarization of the Sky, on page 74, and it is a picture from the Nogun Ri Peace Museum in South Korea. And I'm just going to read the caption, and this is going to get us into the story about the Nogun Ri Massacre, which is one of these hidden nightmares. So the Nogun Ri Massacre, which happened on July 26, 1950, was one of many similar tragedies in which Korean civilians were killed or injured. North Korean soldiers were suspected to have infiltrated parties of civilian refugees. The U.S. response was to strafe all such parties. And then there's a reference to a memo, which we'll be talking about, which is also available on our show resources page, the Rogers Memo. But the first thing I want to say about this caption, I want to just ask you to elaborate on, Charlie, is just, so this is about the Nogun Ri massacre, which was hidden and buried, as we'll discuss. But I have found that the word strafe is not really understood by the average person. And there's no reason why they should, because it's not something that is encountered in daily life in the United States. Could you just talk about what that word means, strafe or strafing?
Sure. Strafing is a term used in warfare for aerial attacks, not by bombs, but by machine guns that are mounted on fighter planes and fighter bombers. Although I think in our usage in our books, this also covers the dropping of bombs at times, along with the strafing and the firing of rockets by these fighter bombers, in particular jet fighter bombers. So the attacks on refugee columns, for example, mostly comprised strafing with machine guns, the mounted machine guns, but they would also at times include rocketing and dropping of 500-pound bombs on a road. So the planes are generally mounted with 50 caliber machine guns, which are very heavy caliber, very, very devastating ordnance bullets. And the strafings were a regular feature in those days, particularly early in the war in mid-1950, and again then a surge in strafings in early 1951 for particular reasons. The Nogin Rhee massacre has two elements, as I've just mentioned. There were ground troops that fired on the refugees, but it began with an aerial strafing. And perhaps I should talk about the genesis of the story journalistically.
Yeah.
Hope, would
yeah,
that
like,
be
because
a good idea?
How did this story come to before we get into the details of it, if you could talk about, because you know, we've been talking about this hidden, the hidden war and the hidden stories and the hidden war. And
yeah,
if you could talk
why,
about how this came on, how this became unearthed.
Yeah, why it was hidden. Well, of course, after the war, the Syngman Rhee authoritarian government continued to rule in South Korea. And then eventually, although there was a brief interlude in 1960, of a democratic system, just less than a year, the South Korean military took over, and with successive military dictatorships. And during this period, and we're speaking 1953 on up to the late 1980s, it was very, very difficult for the Korean people to speak up about such things as atrocities committed by their own government against the South Korean people during the war, and of course during the 50s, 60s, 70s as well. Anyone who spoke out like that was labeled a communist and imprisoned, at times even executed. And so the survivors of this particular massacre, the Nogin Rhee massacre, and the survivors were both people who were actually at the scene, and they were mostly children who survived because they were burrowing under piles of bodies, and also other relatives who perhaps escaped or just were not there at the time, but they lost their loved ones, and they wanted to see something done, but they knew they couldn't. They couldn't speak up about what happened. But finally, the system in South Korea began liberalizing in the late 1980s and democratizing. And in 1994, one of the survivors, a man named Chung Eun Young, who lost two children at Nogin Rhee, two small children were killed, and his wife was badly wounded. He was not there. His wife was badly wounded. He had been researching the history, researching what happened there, who might have been responsible, for years, and he published a book in 1994. That actually had to be presented as a novel in order for a publisher to accept it, but it was a truthful rendition of what happened, although he didn't know who committed it, but from the Korean point of view, it was a truthful rendition. And this began to get some attention in the Korean media, and my AP colleague, Sang-hun Che, had just joined the AP in Seoul at this point, and he proposed doing a story about the book and about the allegations of an American massacre of Korean refugees. But he was told no, that by his bosses, that they weren't interested in such a story. And unfortunately, the fact is that the American media are quite allergic, have long been quite allergic to stories, negative stories about the U.S. military along these lines. Finally, in 1997, the survivors filed a claim with the Claims Commission in Seoul, seeking compensation for what happened to their families. And once again, Sang-hun wanted to write about it, and this time he was able to write a story. He was allowed in Seoul to write the story, but when it arrived at New York AP, it was killed, as we call it. It was not used. And fortunately, there were editors in New York who said, well, at least we should pursue it perhaps on the American side and see what we might be able to establish via the U.S. military. And that's how we, more and more of us, got involved, and we formed a team, and we ultimately were able to confirm the story, number one, by finding documents, declassified military documents in the National Archives that showed colonels and generals issuing orders to fire on civilians. And it was because of this fear of infiltration by North Korean soldiers disguised as refugees. And then we, very elaborate, meticulous weeks of work, tracked down soldiers who were there. And they corroborated what we'd been told by the Korean survivors. And so we had our story at that point. Of course, this was in late July 1998. We then faced a year of struggle within the Associated Press to get the story published. There was great resistance at the top of the Associated Press to publishing the story, but it was finally published in September of 1999.
And in 1997, that is when Kim Dae-jung became president of South Korea. Is that correct?
I believe that's the year, yeah.
Yeah. So I just want to mark that because, yeah, a lot happened under his leadership in terms of getting more of these stories out and unearthing these hidden stories. I want to just open it up to anybody, the other hosts on the show, if you have any questions or follow-up points that you want to make. If you're... Okay, Taylor, we'll get you in a second. Let me just say also, if you are interested in asking a question of Charlie Hanley, you can call in at 516-387-1449. Okay, Taylor, go ahead.
I was wondering, Charlie, if you found during your interviews and uncovering the massacre, if the soldiers you talked to expressed remorse, and if the... Koreans who lost their loved ones were asking for accountability or asking for a formal apology. What were they seeking?
The Korean survivors who were organized under Mr. Chung, their standard demands were for an investigation, an apology, and confirmation by the U.S. government. The soldiers, and of course there eventually was an investigation by the U.S. Army, the soldiers, the veterans, yes, they were very remorseful, particularly, of course, the ones who would discuss it with us, and not just remorseful, but also very, very affected and disturbed through the rest of their lives by what they did or witnessed at Nogun Ri. Because of that year-long delay in publishing, we continued working on the story, getting deeper and deeper and seeing new connections and whatever. And we learned along the way that really every one of the soldiers was psychologically damaged by Nogun Ri. They were all taking drugs, Veterans Affairs prescribed drugs for post-traumatic stress disorder. They would have terrible nightmares and even waking dreams and flashbacks of ghosts. They thought of them as ghosts that they would see. So they were very much affected and very remorseful. And not just about Nogun Ri. I mean, every war is a horror show, and every soldier has seen and, in many cases, done horrible things that they cannot forget the rest of their lives. So thankfully, we found the guys who were willing to talk, and when we published the journalism, we wrote that we had a dozen, which is an approximation to use the term dozen soldiers, because their confirmation came in varying degrees. Some would give us a lot of detail, some would just say, I know what you're talking about and it happened, but I'd really rather not talk about it further, that sort of thing. But we eventually, for the book, the Nogin Rhee book, we had about 25 or so veterans that we interviewed. And in the subsequent Army investigation, they turned up, I think it was 9 other men whom we didn't know about that they interviewed. If I can quickly tell you one story. My colleague, Martha Mendoza, was visiting South Carolina to do TV. AP has a TV arm, and we were finally allowed, after a year's struggle, we were finally allowed to get AP Television involved and go out and interview some of the veterans on video. And she was in South Carolina to interview one veteran, but learned that one of our original interview subjects was hospitalized, but was getting over a very severe brain trauma. He told her, at this point, we hadn't published, and they knew we were having some kind of difficulty publishing, and he told her that he knows why he's being cured of this problem, this neurological problem. It's because he finally talked about Nogin Rhee. In other words, he believed that God was curing him because he was talking about Nogin Rhee, and he said to her, you've got to get that story out. You've got to get that story out, because obviously he seemed to feel that he might have a relapse if we didn't get our story out. So they were very affected, very grateful to get this off their chest, and that we could finally write about it, publish that story.
I have a follow-up question to that, if you don't mind. And it's so I'll contextualize it by saying, my experience in Nogin Rhee in 2015 was prefaced by the death of my father, and what essentially I thought was what I was thinking to do was to run away and go to the other side of the planet and to experience something to get myself away from death. And when I arrived in Nogin Rhee, what was waiting for me there was this unbelievably deep experience of death in the most, you know, in the most horrific way I could imagine, where, you know, civilians were, you know, thought they were, you know, going and doing things that they were supposed to do and then gunned down. And for some reason, to me, that experience helped me psychologically, in some sense, come to terms with death, because for whatever reason, this, you know, this touch of death, you know, became something that I had a new way of, you know, putting a frame around. And I'm curious, you know, when you were doing your reporting on the Nogin Rhee incident, or any of your colleagues were, I was wondering, like, were there lots of stories about how getting this information into the consciousness of either them or the people they were interviewing seemed to have this kind of healing effect other than just the soldiers? Like, did that seem to be something that showed up all the time?
Well, as I say, the soldiers, I was frankly surprised. Well, first of all, I guess I underestimated the skills of my colleagues at the AP in tracking down the men involved. This took some real smart journalism, particularly by Martha Mendoza, because when I first got involved, and I was the last of the team to get involved, and there were 4 of us, the 3 that Hope named, plus Randy Hirschhaft was our incredibly brilliant researcher. When I first got involved, I told the editor, I don't think we're going to find these guys, because I thought it was a small group, you know, a squad-sized group or a platoon-sized group, like at My Lai in Vietnam. Turned out it was an entire battalion. In other words, 500-600 men were aware of, if they weren't involved, they were aware of what was going on. And we tracked them down because Martha did something that I never would have thought to do, and that is she found the coordinates twice a day coordinates reported by the Army units at the time, or through the whole war, and actually pasted up topographical Army topographical maps from 1950 on all the walls of the investigative team's office, and then traced every unit across the whole landscape in that area, not all of South Korea, of course, but just in that area, because we knew where it happened. And with that, we were able to narrow it down to four battalions that were in the general vicinity. And that's what we then, Randy Hirschhaft, the researcher, went to the National Personnel Records Center in St. Louis, obtained rosters from 1950 through a FOIA, a Freedom of Information Act request, and then started tracing through databases, tracing the names of men in those units. And then Martha and I started doing cold calls to these veterans, and it took a lot of calls until we found one. And then we began, we were able to narrow it down further. But I was surprised, first of all, at the skill of my colleagues, but secondly, at how badly the men needed to get this off their chest. So for them, it clearly was a cathartic sort of experience. How did you know to call me? Let me tell you about it. You know, they were just amazed and grateful. As far as the effect on us, you know, as a journalist, you see and learn a lot of things that are pretty shocking, but you just have to, you know, be professional about it and just move ahead. I mean, there were times when I can remember my hand shaking a bit on the keyboard as I'm talking to somebody on the telephone doing an interview and learning something. I can reread parts of the Bridget Nogan Rhee and start tearing and feel a little overwhelmed at what really happened. And now the new book as well, there are episodes that are just stunning and very affecting to even me as a reader. But the reality of death that you so eloquently describe is something journalists, you know, I covered a number of wars live. Korea, I was 2 years old, but I was in Vietnam with the Army, and then I covered wars for the AP. And you see a lot of horrible things, but you know what you're thinking is, I've got to get back to a phone. I've got to do this. I've got to do that, and report. So I wouldn't say it affected us all that terribly.
And I just want to remind us that, you know, this catharsis that's happening in 1999 approximately, it goes back to Chung Eun-young and his writing this book. And he died in 2014, and I did put his obituary, which was in the New York Times, on the show resources page at virtuesofpeace.com. But the story of, you know, him, his experience, and then writing it down, and the transmission of that act of pain, and it's more complex than we're talking about, because it involves his son, Chung Kudo, who now is the heir. Like he's sort of carrying on the work and getting the story out. But this, you know, travels, and the story travels and reaches these soldiers that you encounter, and there's this healing of the truth getting out and being uncovered and being acknowledged, and we're still doing that with this war, because as we've said, it's a hidden war, and there are hidden nightmares in this hidden war, and this is a process of a lot of heavy lifting. Before we go into some of the memos and some of the documents that were unearthed as part of this reporting, any other follow-up questions, thoughts from any of the co-hosts? Going once, twice.
I'll
go ahead.
Yeah, I'll just cap that set of ideas off by, you know, recounting like the experience at the, like, in Nogunri now, there's a large structure or set of structures that help retell the story so that it doesn't just get swept away into, you know, into dust. And, you know, the experience there was almost constantly this, like, deep feeling of internal healing that came as a personal acknowledgement of this event presented some kind of internal healing situation that I don't really have better language to describe, but I know that everybody in the room was constantly saying that in the group discussions we were having. It's like something about the truth of stories like this packages something that people need. And it's not just that people like it. It's not that it's like something fun. It's that it's something that people need. And that's there's a distinction there that I think is so incredible. And so in any case, like, the experience there carried an enormous weight and transformed my internal landscape. And so I'm not surprised in some sense to hear that that's what the people who were there when the massacre occurred were carrying their whole lives. Like, that sounds like a nightmare to me.
Well, you know, there's a word that we see very often in the news, and that's closure. And that, despite the fact that the U.S. government treated the survivors so badly and in effect disrespected them with a horribly whitewashed investigation, the very fact that the massacre was acknowledged, beginning with the Associated Press story, was a major threshold for the people, the Koreans involved, for them to pass. Because I remember Mr. Chung's wife, Park Sun-young, she said at the time after we published, she said, now I can die in peace, she said. So there's a lot that's accomplished by simply reporting and recording and acknowledging events like this, because it somehow restores dignity to the people whose lives were taken and who otherwise would sort of be officially, now, you know, journalists are not officials, but they are a public medium. So now at least it's recognized that they were killed unjustly, and they're not simply forgotten and considered not worth acknowledging.
Yeah, I mean, because this is really it's really about being heard and the respect and the acknowledgement of the dignity of persons requires us to hear and listen, and that is just a very fundamental act. I think we've talked about it before on this show with other moments in Korean history, but insofar as this continues to be a forgotten war and these stories are largely unknown, Nogunri is not in Seoul. It's in Yeongdong province, and so it's some effort to get there. It's not totally, you know, easy to get to Nogunri. And I didn't learn about Nogunri until I had an encounter with Dr. Chung in The Hague in 2013. So that is how the story was transmitted to me. And that was the 100th anniversary of the Peace Palace in The Hague. And a lot of, you know, different people were there. And that is how I learned about it. And so, but yes, being heard. And this underscores the importance of us continuing to, like, do this work of learning about this hidden war and the hidden stories therein. So let's move on. And I think that probably what's going to happen today, again, this story is about looking at the Korean War through the barbarization of the sky. And so the Nogunri Massacre is a story about the barbarization from the skies in the south, Nogunri being a massacre that was in South Korea. And I think what's going to happen today, given the time that we have left, is we will We won't get to the north. We'll come back next week and talk about the barbarization of the sky in the north. But let us continue with this Nogun Ree unearthing. And Charlie, you have some different documents that helped us to unearth this story. So
right.
Can you first talk about the Rogers memo, which is in our show resource page, as I mentioned? Yeah.
If I may, Hope, let me first, in just a couple of sentences, summarize what happened at Nogun Ree, just to make sure that's clear to everyone. And this is late July 1950, 1 month into the war. People in two villages in Yangdong County, villages of Chugok Ree and Imke Ree, are chased from their villages by American troops because the North Korean army is advancing and is approaching. They eventually form a caravan of probably 600 people going down the road trying to go south. And they're stopped by American troops, by different American troops, chased off the road to nearby railroad tracks. And while they're there, pulling out lunch, et cetera, they're attacked from the air by U.S. warplanes. Many are killed. Then the survivors are either flee or in some cases are led by U.S. soldiers down under a railroad bridge, a twin tunnel concrete railroad bridge. And over the next 3 days, many more are killed by ground fire from ground troops in the 7th Cavalry Regiment. Now, as I mentioned, the reason for this, if you want to legitimate it as a reason, but is fear of infiltrators from the North Korean invasion force, infiltrators disguised as refugees among the columns of civilians coming down the roads. And so first, very quickly, I'll just mention some of the U.S. Army orders that were involved here, documents that we uncovered. And before getting to the ones that we at the AP uncovered, there is one overarching document that actually was uncovered by a Harvard historian later, after we published, and it was a State Department document. The ambassador, the U.S. ambassador in Korea, John Muccio, sent a letter on July 25 back to the State Department. This was the day before the killings began at Nogun Ree. And in this letter, Ambassador Muccio said that there had been a meeting and the Army has decided to open fire on refugee groups. And what it says precisely is leaflet drops will be made north of U.S. lines. No, I can't read this, but, you know, urging, telling the people not to proceed south, that they risk being fired upon if they do so. If refugees do appear from north of U.S. lines, they will receive warning shots, and if they then persist in advancing, they will be shot. Now, Ambassador Muccio explains, I'm writing this to you at the State Department because of the likely repercussions if news of this gets out, likely repercussions in the States. But then earlier, before in the initial Associated Press research at the National Archives in particular, Randy Hirschhaft and Martha turned up documents at various unit levels of the U.S. Army in the days just before, a day or two or three before the killings at Nogun Ree, and then in days following as well. And these documents say such things as no refugees to cross the front line, fire everyone trying to cross lines. There was a general Eighth Army, you know, throughout the whole war front order. No refugees will be permitted to cross battle lines at any time. There was an order in a unit close to Nogun Ree, but not involved at Nogun Ree, in which the general, the division commander, told all of his units, any civilians seen should be considered enemy and action taken accordingly. and that was relayed by one of his underlings as considered as unfriendly and shot. And on and on. Later, when they were holding, the Americans were holding a defense line along the Nakhtang River. This was in August of 1950, just a couple of weeks after the Nogin Ri killings. A regimental commander ordered his troops, shoot all refugees coming across river. And a division commander, general, called his artillery unit and told them that refugees, quote, are fair game, unquote. So those are some of the documents that were uncovered showing these orders to indiscriminately kill civilians, which, of course, is a war crime. And then this did begin, Nogin Ri began, as I said, with an aerial strafing. We still don't know in particular what U.S. Air Force or U.S. Navy air unit carried this out, but we know why they did, because of, as Hope mentioned, something we call the Rogers Memo. Now, this, too, is dated the day before the killings began at Nogin Ri, the killings that began with a strafing from the air of the refugees. This is a memo from the number 2 Air Force, U.S. Air Force officer in Korea, to the number 1. And he's the number 2 is concerned about what they're doing, about strafing refugees. And the subject line of this document is, subject, policy on strafing civilian refugees. So it's very clear, very blatant. And in the middle of this document, the colonel says, the Army has requested that we strafe all civilian refugee parties that are noted approaching our positions. And then his next paragraph is, to date, we have complied with the Army request in this respect. So that establishes that there was this theater-wide, warfront-wide policy to strafe refugees, just as the Muccio letter, the Ambassador Muccio letter, confirms that there was a warfront-wide policy on the ground of shooting refugees. And again, this colonel, writing to his general, recommends that the Air Force not do this. Don't attack civilian refugees unless they are definitely known to contain North Korean soldiers. And he too writes that he's telling the general about this because it may cause embarrassment if it gets out. And then what we found in our research were what are called mission reports, which are the debriefings of U.S. Air Force pilots after they flew missions in Korea. And these were mission reports all around the time of Nogin Ri, before and after. And these were found, by the way, the Army documents, as I said, were found by Randy and Martha at the National Archives outside Washington. These Air Force documents were found at Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama, which is the home of the Air Force Historical Research Agency, which is where they keep many of their classified and declassified archival documents. But these after-mission reports by pilots noted that, for example, planes strafed, quote, people in white, unquote. There were about 50 in the group, unquote. Now, people in white, the South Korean, people in rural South Korea invariably wore white. In fact, they were known historically to the Chinese as the people in white. And so these clearly were civilians, these 50 people who were strafed in this instance. In another report, another mission, the pilots reported that they strafed people, quote, who could have been refugees, unquote. And this is all on orders of airborne controllers. These were men flying around in light prop planes who were communicating by radio with incoming fighter bomber missions, and the missions were usually three or four planes. Another after mission report says Air Force planes, quote, strafed sandbar in river where people and foxholes were seen. People appeared to be evacuees, unquote. But they were just going ahead and strafing these people. And they knew, it's clear from many interviews we did and other evidence, it's clear that the pilots knew they were being told to strafe civilians. So this is the barbarization of the sky in the South very early in the war. And it continued, as I said earlier, because of the seesaw nature of the war. By early 1951, once again there were refugees flowing south, and once again the U.S. Air Force and the U.S. Navy planes were strafing refugee groups.
And in the barbarization of the sky, Bertha von Suttner, I mean, the machine gun had not been installed on an aerial vehicle at the time, and she does not talk about strafing. So this is a development, an unhappy development. So I just want to point that out. She does talk about dropping explosives, and I think that's what was imagined. I want to go into a like sort of very general discussion about you said it's a war crime to fire on civilians, and I want to talk about that a bit. But before we get to that, any of the co-hosts have a follow-up question or comment?
I'd be interested. I know this is going to uncork a long conversation, but I'd be very interested to know, first of all, whether there was any way to accurately determine like an estimated death count of civilian casualties during the Korean War. And then similarly, you know, what was the justification? Because it's, you know, yeah, okay, there's the potential for North Korean people being, or they were infiltrating these refugees, like caravans essentially, but like, how could there not be any level of discrimination across the board for the entire duration of the, you know, it's just like, was there any rational component to this, or are we dealing with, you know, that's where I'm at.
Yeah, no, that's a very good central question, of course. And first of all, I'll note that on the ground, it's estimated, I believe it was about 400,000 South Korean refugees in those very first weeks were able to cross American lines and find safety in the U.S. South Korean held territory in the far southeast of South Korea. So clearly many, many officers, no matter what they were hearing from up above, were using basic humanity to let them go through. In fact, while the killings of the Nogin Ri refugees was going on, farther to the southwest, a refugee column had actually teamed up with a U.S. Army column, a retreating U.S. Army column, to help cut a path through the forest, through the brush, so the Americans and the South Koreans could flee together, the refugees and the soldiers could flee farther south together. So clearly many, many officers were using a good common sense and humanity to deal with this situation. And we found this in another way as well, and that is that different units, different branches of service would behave differently. It generally depended upon, in other words, my sense is that the Marines, for example, seemed to be more professional and more humane than the Army troops. And this always depends on the officering, as they call it, using it as a verb, the officering of a particular unit. good officers produce good troops, and bad officers like Lieutenant Calley at the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, bad officers produce atrocities. As far as the air attacks, as I say, the pilots knew what they were doing. There was either late in the war or immediately post-war study within the Air Force about the general morale and pilot attitudes, et cetera. And it very openly discussed the fact that some pilots were disturbed by what they were made to do, attacking civilian columns, attacking refugees. And I remember one was quoted as saying that he was going out peasant hunting today, but he meant it not in an evil way, but he meant it that he couldn't believe what he was being made to do. He called it peasant hunting, and I think it was noted that this man took to drink, etc., and had a very difficult time. And sometimes it was openly, blatantly acknowledged that there was a post-war book very early in the 50s by a pilot named Dean Hess, who later became, I guess the theme of the book was that he later became a minister of the cloth, and his faith saw him through the war and whatever. But he wrote about strafing refugees trying to cross the Nakhtang River. Now, he was being ordered to do this, and he simply followed the orders. And then he wrote that he later was regretful because he learned that many of those people might have been Christian. I guess he didn't understand there were Korean Christians, you know. And so what he cared about was their religion, but not particularly their humanity. But there clearly was a great deal of racism involved here, a great deal of racism. I mean, that's the basic explanation, that there was this disdain for the value of the Korean life. In fact, the general commanding the 1st Cavalry Division, which was responsible for the Nogin Ri massacre, the 7th Cavalry Regiment was part of the 1st Cavalry Division. This was the general who later, by the way, issued the order that refugees are fair game. But early on, he referred to the refugees on the road as trash, and that we should get this trash off the road. And this man, the incompetence could be astounding. This man claimed to reporters, this general, he claimed to reporters that half these people coming down the road are North Korean infiltrators, when the fact of the matter is that none of them were, I dare say. We found no, and we scoured the documents. The only evidence we ever found was a report that a woman was found with a radio, you know, hidden in her clothes. Otherwise, this infiltration rumor was just that. It was a rumor, but it got an official imprimatur from the generals when they started issuing these orders.
That's such useful information, and thank you, Randy, for the question, and thank you, Charlie, for that answer. And we have around 10 minutes left, so what I would like to do is just follow up on these points. This indiscriminate attack on civilians that we're talking about, there's an evolution in international law that we see, and the notion of attacking civilians as a war crime or a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions. This is something that happens after World War II. We mentioned last time, the first show in this series, that the 1907 Hague Conventions do acknowledge prohibiting the dropping of explosives from balloons, and there's also a provision that prohibits a naval bombardment from the Navy on, quote, undefended towns. So you see there some sort of recognition that you really should not be killing non-combatants. But it's really, you know, after World War II and the experience of the bombing, the carpet bombing, the dropping of incendiaries, Berlin, Dresden, Tokyo, and of course Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that these bombings are so indiscriminate. And therefore, you know, the Geneva Conventions, there needs to be some, like, new restraint put on armed conflict. And so you do get the Geneva Conventions of 1949. Now, this is so interesting because 1949, I think it's August 1949. 1949 is not far away from 1950. And last week, our show was on Juneteenth. And Juneteenth is a story, and so, like, you mentioned racism, let's just, you know, like, connect the dots here. Juneteenth is a story about how long it takes a written order or law to come to life in human beings, because Juneteenth is about how the Emancipation Proclamation was not implemented in Texas until 2 years later, 1865, and then, you know, a Union general had to march in and say, you didn't get the memo. So that's 2 years. So the Geneva Convention of 1949, I think it's August 1949, and I'm pretty sure the United States did not, although they signed it in 1949, they do not ratify it. That is, it doesn't become like actual law, like written law. And this gets into a whole discussion about what is your philosophy of law? Are you a positivist? Are you a natural law theorist? We're not going to go there now. But just, I'm pretty sure they don't ratify, and this is the Fourth Geneva Convention, it's Article 147, which is the grave breaches provision, which does prohibit the willful killing of civilians, unless, and there's always an unless, unless it's necessary, unless it's a military necessity to do it. So so that's number one. My point is, it's like this experience after World War II that causes people to say, hey, we really need explicit provisions protecting civilians. This is not a long time ago. So this is 1949 where it's like explicitly put into this Fourth Geneva Convention. Does anybody want to comment on that? Or, I mean... I'm just trying to just get through some of the legal history, but any.
Well, you know, let me point out something, Hope, and that is that during our reporting on Nogin Re, Martha Mendoza and I went up to West Point with a couple of the early documents we had turned up, a couple of the early what we call kill orders, shoot refugees, shoot civilians, and we met with the leading law of war expert at West Point, Gary Solis, and we showed him these documents, and the shock on his face was worth a photograph. He had to reread it and say that I've never heard of anything like this other than the Nazi SS in World War II. And then he said, and I suppose during the Indian Wars in the American West, there may have been written orders like this to target innocents, and that's a good way to put it. It's a war crime to target noncombatants. In other words, that's your purpose. It's not that you're bombing a military target and some civilians get killed, but that you're actually issuing orders to shoot all refugees trying to cross the river, as happened in this case. You know, interestingly, if I may add, my new book, Ghost Flames, as I said, it features 20 individuals, and I follow them through the whole war and tell the story of the war that way. And a couple of them are at the top. General Peng Tae-wai, who was the Chinese overall commander, Chinese-North Korean overall commander, and General Matthew Ridgway, who was the American overall commander from December of 1950 until the spring of 52. At the end, he later went to NATO as commander in Europe of NATO, this American general. And there was a debate in Europe at the time. Some leading Germans wanted to have sentences of Nazi generals commuted so that they could be brought back into the military to face the Soviet threat, quote-unquote, of the early Cold War. Now, these Nazi generals had been convicted of heinous crimes, including the murder of Jews, the murder of political prisoners, the murder of military prisoners, and such. And Ridgway was asked his opinion on this in a formal sort of way, and he wrote back and told the commissioners who oversaw Germany at that time, the tripartite commissioners, American, British, French, that he favored commuting the sentences. In other words, to strengthen NATO, he favored commuting the sentences, although he said he only favored it for generals who had been fighting on the Soviet front. Ridgway by this time was quite an anti-communist. So generals who committed crimes against the Americans or the French, the British, they should stay in jail, but others should be freed who fought against the Soviets. And then Ridgway went on and said, these men have been convicted of things that I myself carried out, orders like I issued in Korea. Mm-hmm. Now, he didn't specify which orders he meant, but he did issue some pretty blood-curdling orders for shooting civilians during his time, particularly as 8th Army commander in Korea from December 50 onward. During the evacuation of Seoul in January of 1950, when the Chinese were closing in on Seoul, and Seoul was about to fall to an army for the third time, in just several months of war, he issued an order telling his troops to shoot civilians who were trying to cross the Han River. This was late in the evacuation. Many, many civilians did evacuate. But then at the end, he issued a final order saying no more, because of the fear of infiltrators, shoot any civilians who were trying to cross the river. Mm-hmm. And so this targeting noncombatants is indeed a war crime. And General Ridgway himself seemed to acknowledge that in his writing to the commissioners in Germany. But, you know, as is often said, the victors are never guilty of war crimes. It's only the vanquished who are guilty of war crimes.
Mm-hmm. And, I don't know as much as Gary Solis. He's one of the foremost experts on the law of armed conflict. But from what I've read, the ultimate objective, and this is what we in philosophy call practical reasoning, that this, you know, there's an objective and there's a means by which you achieve that objective. And what are the legitimate means to the ultimate objective in war, which is to get the quote-unquote enemy to surrender, and what's on the table? What is permissible? And terrorizing civilians. I mean that. So there's the targeting of civilians, and 1949, that is seen to not be permissible. But the last sentence does say that's not justified by military necessity. So there are these other values. This is what's concerning to me, that, you know, the military can argue that this is necessary. And this is why nuclear weapons still remain, if you look at positive law, legal. But one could say they're illegal from a different view of philosophy of international law. But insofar as the civilians are part of like North Korean soldiers infiltrating groups of civilians, you could anticipate the argument that, well, this is necessary to win, and it's not that we're targeting. We, as you said, there are warnings given and so forth, and that you see that language that you need to, if you're going to fire onto an undefended town, you have to warn. You have to give warnings. So there's warnings given. So it's not, I'm just anticipating this argument. It's not targeting, and that this is, quote, collateral damage, which is, killing people is permissible if it's collateral damage. Yes, you can't target them willfully and wantonly. And I'm not happy with this either. I think it's very concerning that killing any, and this is the argument that the United States makes when it, tries to and succeeds in its position on the legality of the threat or use of nuclear weapons. They say, look, yes, these weapons don't discriminate. These are indiscriminate weapons, but that's not the only value here. There's also proportionality, and if the military objective is valuable enough, we can kill hundreds of thousands of civilians. That's, as I understand, what the military, they do argue this in 1996 at the International Court of Justice. So my point is that in 1949, we're so like accustomed to terrorizing and killing civilians through these aerial bombardments. You're talking about artillery, but aerial bombardments, it's just like there's this callous disregard for the lives of civilians when we're bombing cities. We don't have this experience in the United States, right? That we don't, like New York City has not been bombed from the air. We have Pearl Harbor and we have 9/11. Those are our experience of aerial barbarization. But this was done in World War II. And so I think that kind of like habit, if you will, or I'm not saying it's good. I'm just pointing it out. And I'm pointing out that so we try to stop that with the 1949 Geneva Convention and this explicit, like you don't really see this explicit protection of civilians. That's the fourth Geneva Convention. And so it took a while to sort of come to consciousness that we really shouldn't be doing this. And even the 1949 Geneva Convention doesn't have the teeth that it should. And so this is why we have the what's called the 1977 Protocol, which I won't go into now. Maybe it's something we do next time. But let me stop there and see if anybody has anything to round out this conversation with, because we've been going for over an hour.
Yeah, I have one last question. So, you know, in all of the study of atrocities, the theme that I've found consistent was that buried beneath the horror there are these consistent stories of remarkable individuals that somehow managed to rally the moral and spiritual energy of the victims and pull things together in some remarkable and miraculous way. And I was wondering if any of the individuals in the new book that you managed to spotlight in some sense capture this kind of spirit and can provide some form of inspiration for us so that, you know, when we think of the Korean War, we're not just, turning our head because it's so horrific and perhaps, you know, deliberately have something to focus on that that can pull us in and, you know, force us to learn in some sense.
Well, I guess a number of the Korean characters of mine are very solicitous of their fellow man and try to be helpful with refugees, etc. There's one young, very interesting but in the end tragic story of a 16-year-old South Korean boy who joins the army because he's starving. He ends up in North Korea when the Americans and South Koreans invade North Korea in September, October of 1950. And north of Pyongyang, he's a military policeman, and north of Pyongyang, he's in his Jeep with his driver, and they spot a little girl in a burning village, totally destroyed village, and she's really the only human being they see, and she's distraught. And he puts her in the Jeep, takes her back to his base in Pyongyang, and feeds her, and then turns her over for safekeeping with a family he's gotten to know in Pyongyang. Then the Chinese are coming down on Pyongyang, and a great retreat occurs. They called it the Big Bug Out. The American soldiers called it the Big Bug Out. And he goes and rounds up this 9-year-old girl. She's lost her whole family. She's very traumatized, but she eventually tells the story about how she lost her family. And he puts her with this couple from Pyongyang on a train south, and tells her that he'll find her later on, because he knows the train is going through Kaesong and then down to Seoul. And he's in Kaesong on the retreat. They're still pulling back, and he decides to go look for her because it seems that particular train stopped in Kaesong and didn't go on. And this is the middle of the winter, of course, at this point. This is December. And he goes through the train yard. He goes through the station, which is packed with refugees. He doesn't find her. He goes through the train yard and starts looking in the boxcars, fearful for what he might find. And, yeah, sure enough, in the corner of the last boxcar he inspects, he sees this little figure in the corner, and he goes over and brushes her hair away and brushes the snow off her face, and it's this little girl, and she's frozen, dead and frozen stiff, and so he picks her up and he buries her. But there are stories like this throughout my book, and obviously throughout that war, where people had to help people, and where soldiers, including American soldiers, did some great things. Another character in my book is an American Marinol nun who establishes a clinic in South Korea for refugees. And her story is just full of heartbreaking, but then heartwarming stories of how these nuns saved so many lives through their work. This nun was a physician and a Marinol nun. Randy, I advise you read the book. I think you might you might enjoy it.
Okay.
Great. So we are about out of time, as I anticipated. And just to kind of put a nice bow on it, Barbarization of the Sky, we talked about the Nogonri massacre, the fact that it was hidden, how it was unearthed, the psychological impact of that unearthing, the fact that there was this indiscriminate targeting of civilians, a little bit about international law. And I'll close with an image. We will be back next week, God willing, continuing with, we've just been talking about the South and Nogonri. We haven't even talked about the barbarization of the sky in the North. But if you know the Korean flag, also called the Taguki, you have the center is what we call the yin-yang, and then you have four trigrams in four different corners. And if you start at like the 11 o'clock trigram, that would be heaven or the sky. And opposite that is the earth. And I think that's a fitting sort of image or visual to close with, because we've been talking about the unearthing of this truth, which involves the sky and the barbarization of the sky. And as Bertha von Suttner says, that once you take war to this aspect, this theater, you are, she uses the phrase, it's the profanation of the firmament, that the sky is something poetic and something that stimulates our imagination, and you're going to barbarize it, and that is represented in the Taguki, which I also want to say, this is the flag of the entire peninsula until not the Korean War, but before that, which we mentioned last time, the creation of two different states on the Korean Peninsula in 1948. But before that, you did have this common flag for the whole peninsula. I think that was created in 1882, around there. So I'll close with that so you can learn about the Taguki. I recommend. And you've been listening to Virtues of Peace. Do check out our show resources page for the Rogers memo that we did mention and some other resources, the obituary of Chung Eun-young, and a selection from Charlie Hanley's new book is there as well. So let me say goodbye and ask all of our guests to say goodbye as well.
Bye. Goodbye, and thank you. Thank you very much.
And goodbye, and I enjoyed it very much, and thank you, Hope.
Yeah, it's such an honor, and I'm so, you know, I feel some sort of relief knowing that during the COVID-19 crisis, we were all able to get together and commemorate this extremely important moment that is absolutely essential to understanding where we are today. So hope to be back next week, and peace, and have a good weekend. Bye-bye.